The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Friday. If you are one of those who still has time and the interest in reading as a pastime, there are always books available, wonderful books to read. And our two guests tonight have been friends of this program and yours truly for a long time. They have some books out. Any of their books. Just pick up any of Don Schmidt and Tom Carey's books about Roswell and the whole UFO situation that we're still laboring in terms of this ridiculous government cover-up. And you will be entertained and informed like few other books in this field could ever hope to do. So it's going to be a monthly. We're going to have Don and Tom on every month talking about Roswell, the most arguably famous UFO event in modern contemporary world history. I don't know of any others. So let's say hi to the gang. Welcome back, Don. Thank you for being there.
Well, the Three Musketeers, once a month. That's going to be great, Jeff. We appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. Hello, Tom.
Way to go, Don. Hi, Jeff. Great to be with you again, and it's even greater that we're going to be on in the future as well.
Yeah. Well, we have the great privilege to dip into your treasury of research, and it is unprecedented. And how many books altogether now is it? I've forgotten the number.
I count 12. I don't know how many. I count 12. Is that close, Don?
Yes. In fact, my wife just the other night, she asked Alexis. And Alexis came immediately back. And overall, for me, she went 16.
That's right.
That was spot on. So I didn't have to prompt or correct the answer.
Well, the amazing thing, and I want to repeat this, about Don and Tom's books is that they are extraordinary, utterly unique, and really unprecedented in what they do with an event that was meant to go away in 1947 and never be talked about. And they have pulled so much out of the past, the present, and many people, of course, most all of them really are no longer here. They're gone. And it was an enormously important event and the stuff of legend. And it's all captured in their books as well as other subjects.
You.
You're welcome. No, all of us owe you both a tremendous debt of gratitude for the work you've done. Extraordinary work, just the likes of which you don't see anymore. Talk about real research, following leads, creating leads to follow in some cases, and getting to the people before they checked out. And that's the subject of this first episode tonight, Roswell, Deathbed Confessions. And it was a race against Father Time. When you guys got going, you knew you had only so much time. These people were getting up there.
Well, from the very from the very first, and Don will back me up on this, from the very first, our friend and colleague Stanton Friedman early on said we were racing the Undertaker. And this is like the early 1990s, the late 1980s, and we're thinking, oh my goodness, what's he talking about, racing the Undertaker? Well, the Undertaker has arrived.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I miss, we all do, Stanton. What a wonderful personality, what a great guy. And he was on this program many, many times over the years, and always a delight, just a fine man, fine man.
And the fact that when Stan was originally approached, and this was in the fall of 1988,
uh-huh.
And he was giving a lecture at Lake College in northern Illinois, just north of Chicago.
Right.
And I was only an hour and a half away, so he invited me down for dinner, and you know, I was backstage with him, and I brought up the topic. You know, Stan, do you feel that you've tracked down all the witnesses? Do you feel that you've taken this as far as you can? And much to my surprise, he responded, well, no, Don, I'm sure there are hundreds of witnesses still out there, because uh-huh. that's how big Roswell was and is, for that matter. And, you know, he invited us to immediately, you know, pick up the gauntlet and follow in his footsteps. And at times we competed, Tom and I and Stan, the two of us competed with Stan. And at times we were at odds with Stan. And at times there were not so much feuds over witnesses or scenario or perceptions of what we were discovering. But at the end of the day, we were still always shaking hands, and we were sharing many a panel and a press conference, and because we were presenting a united front. And that was the one thing, Jeff, that was great about Stan. Whenever we did something together, we always had an understanding that we were going to present that which we agreed on. We weren't going to confuse the audience, confuse the people in thinking, well, these guys, you know, they're going in different directions that are coming up as far as with different witnesses and that type of thing. And so he was a professional. He was a scientist. And to me, that's what I miss most, that there was none of this infighting.
Right. That's almost unheard of. Most people would not rise to that level of professional
competition.
Elegance.
Professional,
that's right.
And the fact that their competition would always
that's
shine
right.
through. And
yep.
Stan had nothing to prove, and we had nothing to prove. And
nice.
We realized the case was bigger than all of us, and that's all we had to do is just tell the truth as we had uncovered it.
You know,
couldn't
Jeff,
be any better. Yeah, Tom.
As we sit here, we have contacted upwards of 600 first and second hand witnesses to this event. If we only had the internet back in the early 90s when we got started on this, we would have, you know, increased that number greatly. But the internet only came along from somewhere in the mid 1990s. And that's when I first got it, but I didn't know how to use it that much. And I think the big thing then was we would make phone calls to try to track down witnesses. You had to know not only what state they lived in, but in what city they lived in to call the information on the telephone. And each time that was like a buck. So we would get the phone bills for a month of $600, you know.
Back in the day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And we were using air certification that we were tracking down witnesses, assuming that many of them had been military pilots and that they would have continued as civilian pilots, private pilots. So we were tracking them down that way. We were going through motor vehicle. We were going through the Veterans Administration. We were going through credit unions. We were using every possible means to track these people down, and it all took time, money, effort on our part. And I'm not patting either one of us on the back, but
well, I will if you don't, because you guys did something incredible. You really did, truly.
Well, thank you, and especially at a time when all of our colleagues were even telling us, can't be done. Case is too old, 40, 50 years. No, you won't find anybody. Well, we proved everyone wrong.
Witness to Roswell. What was the first book?
UFO Crash at Roswell.
Okay.
Back in 1991.
Now, I started this program in 94, and I don't know which book it was when you first were on, but Witness to Roswell is, if any of you want to know where to start, that's a towering achievement. Witness to Roswell. There's so many of them, though. They're all good.
That was the first book by Don and myself. The first book, obviously, was the Roswell Incident book in 1980 by William Moore and Charles Berlitz, with Stanton Friedman doing the, you know, the investigation along with Charles Moore. That was the only book for 11 years. The next book that came out was Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall. And to me, that was the book that lit the candle, lit the fire for world interest, the UFO crash at Roswell, 1991. Mm-hmm. And Don and I, after the 50th anniversary year of 1997, the investigative field broke up. They said, well, there's nothing more to learn about this case. We had the big coverage in 1997 by the networks. That's about it. Well, Don and I, the next year in 1998, we met in Chicago at the meeting of the Center for UFO Studies, QFOS. Don came down from Wisconsin, and I flew out to Chicago from Pennsylvania. And Don was I still remember this like it was yesterday. He said, "Well, you know, the case is sort of languishing because you know that big year last year was so big that people are figuring that's the end of it." So Don says, "I'm going to go down to Roswell in May of this year, which was 1998." Mm-hmm. And he says, does anybody want to go along with me? Well, one of the other board members put his hand up and said, it's 50-50. And I said, without hesitation, I said, I'll go, Don. I'll go with you. That was our first trip together as a team in 1998, May, if I recall. Our first book came out in 2007, so it was quite a while that we were gathering more information. First book comes out, Witness to Roswell, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. That was our first of 12 books, Jeff.
Mm-hmm. When you went down there on that first trip, and after this 50th anniversary thing, it kind of, in a way, as you said, put the case to rest. It put it to sleep. It's time to move on. You must have gone down there and been overwhelmed with what hadn't been done. It must have been amazing to think about all the people who had never really been properly talked with and researched.
Well, and the witnesses that we hadn't given up on, the ones that were still reluctant, the ones mm-hmm. who we felt still were withholding, you know, the full story. Mm-hmm. And so we constantly mm-hmm. revisited, you know, these individuals each time. And we were making, you know, four or five trips just to New Mexico a year. And
you both had to gain the confidence of people who were basically sworn to secrecy back in the
yes.
day. And they were going to
yes.
take that to the grave with them. They were not going to let that go. That was their prime directive.
And
their duty to country,
We had to respect that, and we did, because we realized not only very often they were fear of any government repercussion, reprisal as far as breaking that oath, fear for the very safety and well-being of their families.
Mm-hmm.
And it was people like First Lieutenant Walter Haught, who was the public information officer, who actually wrote up, as it was dictated to him by the base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, that very press release where they announced to the world they had captured a flying saucer back on July 8th of 1947.
That was the big whoops. Yeah.
That was the, well, yes and no, because Tom and I, because given that Washington already had material from the crash site in hand 2 days before, it was scripted, it was contrived, and it was intended to get the press off of the brass's back, and it worked. They accepted the balloon explanation. They built it up, then they tore it down, the proverbial straw man. But what I was getting at was the very first time we met with Walter Haught and his wife, and they described to us that for 30 years they were getting threatening phone calls. All hours of the night, even his wife would pick up the phone. And it was always the same thing. Either halt, if you say a word, or his wife, if your husband ever says a word about what happened back at Roswell in 47, there's going to be hell to pay, or, you know, your lives are going to be in danger, that type of thing. And the thought that this was going on for 30 years over a weather balloon.
Right.
And so we realized very early on that Walter must know a lot more than just his writing up that press release, that he had to have seen more, that he was more of a threat to officialdom for the truth that he was withholding. And so Walter was one of those deathbeds, you know, one of those people that we went back to over and over again. And we'll get back to Walter in a few minutes, but Tom, why don't you give another quick example
of
one of our many deathbeds?
Well, literally on his deathbed, Jeff, what we considered a deathbed confession was anybody who knew that they were, you know, on the path to passing away. Somewhere in the last year of their life, for us, someone who had withheld information from family and friends for all those years, but in the last year of their life when they knew they were didn't have much time left, to us that was a deathbed confession. And for me, I think of Major Edwin Easley, who not only gave us the roadmap or the information that we were on the right track back in 1989, when, you know, we were still considering, you know, was this really the crash of a UFO or a flying saucer? And Kevin Randall, I believe, interviewed him by telephone. And as Don mentioned, to every question that Kevin had asked, that Easley would say, "Nope, can't talk. I can't discuss it. I'm sworn to secrecy. I'm sworn to secrecy," over and over and over again. For me, I would have collapsed like a house of cards at that. Kevin, I guess, out of frustration, he said, "Well, can you tell us? Are we going in the right direction?" And Easley says, well, what direction is that? He said, Kevin says, well, we think it was the crash of a flying saucer or UFO. So there's a long pause. And Easley says, well, let me put it this way. You're not going in the wrong direction. So that at least led
the
team
I like
that we were on the right path.
Sure.
Now, as far as his deathbed, which occurred in 1993 at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, same hospital that President Kennedy was rushed to after he was shot. Easley's on his deathbed, and in comes his daughter, his two daughters, and his granddaughter. And they're talking, and the granddaughter brings Easley a gift. He's there in bed, and she brings a gift to him, and she holds up in front of his face a copy of a book, and Easley looks at it, and he just falls back and goes, oh, the creatures. Well, it was a copy of Randall and Schmidt's first book, UFO Crash at Roswell. And to us, that was confirmation, again, that it was a flying saucer and that there were now bodies.
That's what he said. Creatures. That's verbally what he said. The creatures.
Yes. Oh, the creatures. And that was in the presence of the granddaughter and his two daughters. And one of the daughters she's a practicing attorney in Texas. Her name is Nancy Strickland, who we've met with. In fact, she was part of our 2002 dig, which we thought was a great way for her to honor the involvement of her father. And that at the very end, at least he provided them with the truth that he had been sworn to withhold all that time. And to have
by
made
President
such
Truman,
a...
By President Truman.
Did they share that with you directly, willingly, no problem?
Oh, yes. In fact, even his attending physician, Dr. Harold Granick, was immediately told what the colonel had said. And he verified that as well.
Uh-huh. That's a nice story. So he must have been, I'll bet he was relieved to see the book to some degree. It's out there. It's going to be out there. I didn't have to do it. It's there. I would think that would have been a relief. Or did
ahead,
he
Tom.
Worry?
Yeah,
what do you, what
go
do you
ahead,
think?
Don. Go
what
ahead.
Do you think?
Well, he was very apologetic. He was very concerned that, very regretful that he had withheld the information. As Tom mentioned, he described that he had made a promise to the president that he would never...
Directly?
Well, it could have been a representative, but he according to the family, he said, I made a promise to the president that I would never say another word about this. Now, what's interesting about Easley is that the Secret Service sent Easley a document, which we have a copy of, thanking him for his cooperation on that matter that happened in Roswell in the summer of 1947.
See, that's one of the countless little treasures that Tom and Don have come up with over the years. There's probably more evidence about Roswell now than anyone would have ever projected would have been assembled and gathered and pulled together. And you guys did it. It's amazing. Amazing.
Well, we're not through. We're not through.
Understood. All right.
We still have a few things in our quiver that if they turn out, it will be news again, Jeff. We are working on some things. In fact, we got a new witness that in this last week we never would have had without the Internet. It was because of the Internet that we were able to find a witness that our source just couldn't remember his last name. But we were able to search that out, and we found the witness. Of course, it's a secondhand witness now to a first-hander who saw the bodies and the craft. And, you know, we never would have been able to do this back in the early 90s, but thanks to the Internet and search engines, I wish we had it back then.
Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of this secondhand witness and what he was doing at the time? What was his assignment then? Just if you can.
He was the one we're talking about now. Yes.
Yes.
He was a member of the 393rd, if I have that right, bomb squadron, and he was like they all have different jobs, and one of his jobs was as a liaison between the bomb squadron and the public information office. And so he was like an information guy, and he was a tech sergeant, and he talked about seeing the bodies. He was part of the crew that went out there. He saw the bodies, and they all mentioned that one was still alive. That's the key. He said he saw three dead and one still alive, and that he accompanied one of the flights back east, and he talked about the cover-up and all that. Now, my source is just leading me to a more detail-oriented source, and so there's another person who knows a lot more than my source who I talked to yesterday. In fact, he couldn't even remember the last name, and he had to go get that. This whole phenomenon of this, from the first we heard about this until we got the information, it's almost a year since we first heard from our source about this. What intervened was the hurricane in Florida, just upset everything. And so now he's back with us. And this is a very important secondhand witness, because he we know who he was because he's in the yearbook. That was the key.
Ah.
He thought his name was so-and-so. So I looked it up in the yearbook, and sure enough, there he was. So I sent him, I faxed him a picture back. And he sent it to the ultimate source, who owned an establishment, and she said, "Oh yes, that's him." In fact, he showed her the same picture way back when of him in the military. So we knew we had the right guy. The question now is, I have to interview the original source, not the go-between that I've been talking to, and get the full details of what this fellow saw and what he was involved in. It sounds like he saw the bodies. He went back east with one of the flights, perhaps Wright-Patterson, perhaps Washington, D.C., and we know we have the right guy. Back in the early 90s, we never would have found him. We never would have found him.
Fascinating.
But with the search engines we have now and the Internet, we can get most anybody. But unfortunately, they're all gone now.
A couple of things. Both of you saw the X-Files, I guess when they revived it, one of the two seasons they revived it, and they show the creature crawling away from a crashed disc, which is reminiscent, I guess, of Roswell. I don't know if it was supposed to be or not.
It was supposed to be. It was Roswell, yes.
And the guy walked up and shot the creature, killed it.
Right.
Have you anything in all of your years of work that would substantiate that kind of a scenario as having had any truth to it?
Well, I recall vividly watching, and my first impression was they took that from us. In fact, Chris Carter, early into the series at a press conference, the very creator of X-Files,
yes,
was asked, "Isn't it true that you use," and he mentioned at that time, they mentioned Kevin Randall's and my name at the press conference.
Right.
To which Carter responded, "Let's just say we most liberally take from their work."
Well.
Okay, you know, checks in the mail, that type of thing.
Yeah, right.
But then to see the revival series, and then they brought it back, and you're absolutely correct, Jeff, that they had a nighttime as far as retrieval operation out in the desert, mm-hmm, was Roswell, and they shoot the survivor. Now, we've had numerous sources talk about how there was a survivor and it was killed. And to use the very term, it was the late Jack Rodden. His father was Ray Jack Rodden, who was a professional photographer down in the Southwest. And he had worked with the FBI. He had a clearance with the FBI, and he was under contract with the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell because he had a security clearance. And according to Jack, his father was rushed out to the base late one night during this whole flying saucer, before the balloon story hit the press. And the thought was that it had something to do with the flying saucer. So his father returns home that next morning, and he's just staring ahead. He says, glaring ahead as he walks to the front room, and he goes into the kitchen. And he overhears his father mutter, "They killed it." And to which, you know, the young boy Jack, "Well, what are you talking about? The story? Yeah. They just explained it away as a weather balloon." And his father, again, repeats, "They killed it." And then Jack says, "Yes, I know the story. It's not a flying." And he went, "No, I'm not talking about the balloon. But they killed it. And Jack would learn later that his father was rushed out to the base to photograph the bodies, to freeze frame, that they were decomposing very quickly. He was taken to the big hangar, P3, Building 84, where right. everything had transited through. And they had a canvas tarp draped, and they pulled the tarp aside, and there they had one of the bodies propped up in front of a 35-millimeter camera on a tripod. And so he either witnessed something or he heard what had happened, that that was the particular one that they had killed, they had shot.
Remember Mark Mac Magruder, who was a Marine Corps lieutenant colonel who was out at the Wright-Patterson in 48 in this Air War College class, and they were taken into this hangar to view the wreckage and into another room to view the live one. And when he told his sons, he had five sons, and the one that we talked to most was Mark Magruder. And Mark told us, when he asked his father, when his father finally talked about it, because he did not talk about it until late in life, almost on his deathbed. And so Mark asked him, what did the body, not the body, what did the creature look like? And he gave a one-word answer, squiggly. He just said squiggly. So Mark says, well, what became of it? And Mac Magruder said they killed it. He emphasized they killed it. And he says, do you mean they shot it? No. He said, no, they were doing some experiment with it. And in the experiment, whatever it was, it caused the demise of the so-called live one. So there's two episodes of where the term they killed it is applied to Roswell. And like Don says, the X-Files, no doubt that's where they got the idea, think.
Yeah, well, I think you're 100% correct. Was there a survivor beside the one they killed?
I'm only aware of one, Jeff. There may have been one that was close to death. I don't know. But all the witnesses that we have spoken to that were aware of the bodies, they all mentioned that there was one still alive. Now, whether there was one close to death, I personally don't know. I just know of the one that we call the live one.
Right.
And whether it was the family of the sheriff, George Wilcox, or two of the firemen, Dan Dwyer and Ed Reeves, and then personnel at the base hospital, and then like Elazar Benavides, who was one of the guards when they were loading bodies on gurneys into the back of the ambulance truck, and the sheet pulled away, and there he was standing face to face with the live one as it opened its eyes, and 6 inches away, a sight that just haunted him for the rest of his life. It's always come down to just one survivor, whether it was the civilian or the military witnesses
and that,
involved.
That we think is the one that was killed.
Or at least that's what, or the impression, or let's just say, Jeff, we don't have any witnesses to it being killed, or to it dying.
Uh-huh. Now, the guy that saw it, as you just mentioned, at 6 inches away or whatever, did you
Elazar
talk to
Benavides,
him?
Benavides, right.
Did you get to speak with him?
Many times.
Oh, at length. Many times.
Okay.
And Tom will certainly remember quickly, Jeff. It took us well over a year to get him to talk to us.
Yes.
Understood. Well, that's what's so incredible about your work. You had to slowly cultivate the trust and respect of these people, and you did it. That's
remarkable.
You know
what's interesting, Jeff, is back then they didn't call them aliens. They didn't refer to these beings as aliens. They used that the first term they used was little people. The talk around Roswell at the time of the crash was that there were these little people that they found. Another term they used was creatures. Elazar Benavides used the term species.
Like species, a species. Yes.
Yes.
I like
he
that.
He used that term, yes. But the term aliens was never used.
Did the one that survived, the survivor we'll call it, ever end up in the base hospital for some kind of treatment or observation or anything like that? Did they ever put it in care, in other words?
Well, I'm talk about Miriam Bush, Tom.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, when we had interviewed, we had met with her brother, George Bush, no relation to the Bush family. And then there was a sister we had also interviewed. But Miriam had very mysteriously, under very strange circumstances, checked into a hotel just before we found her. And they found her with a plastic bag tied around her head and bruises and scratches all over both arms. And the coroner had ruled it a suicide.
Sure.
Well, the family never believed that. But the story about her was, and it's all confirmed, she was the base hospital's, the administrator's secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And after the hospital had been evacuated, cleared out of the regular staff, the normal medical staff, and all the outside personnel came in, all the strange unknown doctors and nurses and other people, that the administrator was still calling, you know, trying to have some input, and he was failing. So she described how he took her by the arm and he said at one point, I'm going to show you something. And he took her into the OR, into the operating room. And there were bodies under sheets on these gurneys. And her first reaction, her first impression was, my God, they're children. Because they were all small-sized.
Sure.
And then she saw one of them move. And the sheet pulled away, and it was, my God, they're not human. So according to her, according to her family, she saw the survivor at the hospital. Because we've heard from different witnesses that it was in a different state, in a different condition of well-being at different times, that it either needed assistance, it was being carried, it was being lifted. It, at times, was walking with assistance, that type of thing, and even at times having trouble breathing. So
and it was
all of our accounts are witnesses to it still alive again. Nothing about right. after the fact.
How long? How long?
It was the black eyes, the large black eyes that haunted her for the rest of her life.
Yes.
How long
As
was
it? Did,
How long after
As
that
the
did
eyes
they kill?
Did Elazar Benavides, too.
Understood.
Yes.
How long after that was she murdered? My word.
Just before we found her.
Duh.
You're talking late 80, around 88.
Mm-hmm.
Just before we started.
You know, somewhere in a vault, there is an awful lot of film and photography of the crash and the aftermath. It's all recorded.
Oh, yes. Oh,
and
yes.
Wouldn't it be nice for you two especially to be able to see some of that someday? Not to mention the rest of us, but you've done it all. Except see the damn film and photographs. Huh. When you look
and
in the face
of... name
go ahead.
The very photographers. Tom, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we moved the ball from the 50-yard line down to the one-yard line, and the 1 yard we're lacking is what you're just saying, Jeff, photographs and a piece of physical evidence. That would be put us over the goal line.
Very quickly, the alien autopsy film. Can we deal with that real fast? What do we make of that?
Well, for me, it's I can deal with it real fast. It's a hoax.
Okay.
And if you notice the attendants working on the body, they're all covered up so you can't see who they are. It's not that
right.
They're protecting themselves. It's so we can't see who they are. And the bodies do not comport with how they were described to us. To me, it was always a Hollywood prop.
Okay, I just want to put
that
out.
And given
that
you have the very magician, who I know personally, who came forward, and even demonstrated how he had fabricated, how he had put together this entire latex dummy to then create that entire video.
Right.
That's all we need to know.
Okay. End of story. The idea of talking to and looking into the eyes of people who saw the visitors.
Yes.
It's just, to me, it's kind of thrilling journalism. That's real. And for you to be able to think back on those people and their faces, anything come to mind in terms of words, how you would describe them? What were they? Sometimes when people think back on a dramatic event in their life, their eyes kind of glaze over and they go somewhere else. They go back. I've seen it myself in people. How did they react?
Well, just getting back to Elazar quickly and the fact that it took us a year, and that was even with the assistance of his wife, who knew the story from the time they married back in the early 50s. And they had to share that experience, albeit in her case, by his behavior, by his being haunted by that vision. Mm-hmm. According, she described to us how they slept in separate rooms for 40 years because of his nightly nightmares, how he would jolt up in bed night after night after night, yelling out, screaming out from what he had witnessed, from what he had seen. And even when he first broke down, and I mean he literally broke down, and he wept, the tears just flowed like a baby as he told us what he had seen. And it was a release. It was a relief on his part. But to see a grown man, in that situation, and you're either talking about one of the greatest actors we've ever encountered or someone with the corroboration of his own wife describing that face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact. And it just is, it's overwhelming, Jeff. It convinces you beyond any shadow of a doubt.
Well, that's what I was hoping to hear, something like that. That is really amazing. And, what a thing.
Yeah. And there was the base pastor,
Henderson. Religious,
Elijah Hankerson.
Hankerson, yeah.
Yes. He was a black pastor, a Baptist, and on his deathbed, near death, we get this story from his daughter Michelle that he kept referring to things in the universe. There are many mansions in my father's house. I'm just a man. Knowing too much is not always a good thing. And his daughter's thinking, what is he talking about? And he just kept going over and over and over again, these things about the universe and many mansions in my father's house, suggesting that there's life on other planets. That's the way I look at it. And knowing a lot is not always the good. And so he passes away. And so, when your parents pass away, you're left with their belongings, and you try to find a place for them, going through them and all that. She learns that her father had been stationed at Roswell, that he had never mentioned that. She knew every place he had been stationed. Neither her father nor her mother ever mentioned their time at Roswell. And lo and behold, they were at Roswell at the time of the incident. They never mentioned that to their children. So, see, that's when I forget how we got contact on that, whether it was us or Tony Bregaglia in Florida that clued us in on this. But also, he was relieved of his duties during the week of the incident, suggesting that he may have lost it. He may have lost it. They brought in a Catholic priest, and Don can address that. They brought in a Catholic priest to replace Elijah Hankerson.
And it may simply for this reason,
Don.
Jeff. Quickly.
Hold on.
The base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, was a devout Catholic.
Okay.
And we started to suspect, and I talked to enough priests, and they felt that it would be most conceivable that Blanchard would have wanted last rites performed on the bodies. And that may have been the reason that they had a Catholic priest brought in during that week, during that time.
Did they first plug in Elijah to do any kind of last rites, and then he couldn't handle it? Is that why they pulled him off?
Yeah, we don't know that, Jeff. But what Don suggests is certainly suggests that that's what happened. But we, as far as knowing about what happened to Hankerson, other than the fact that he's relieved of his duties at that time in favor of the Catholic priest, that's what we do know.
Something. And Blanchard, the base commander, being Catholic, and last rites is strictly a Roman Catholic sacrament. As far as, and I think Blanchard would have been true to, you know, the Catholic dogma in that regard. And so he would have easily just brought in a priest from within the Roswell itself, if that was the case.
Did you ever get to that priest?
Long gone. We tried. Yeah, we learned, obviously we were even checking out convents. We were checking out everybody and anybody. He had St. Mary's Hospital just to the north, and because we had reports of even some of the sisters, some of the nuns who were involved, and other personnel that were rushed in from outside. Tom could tell you that we're still after a son of one of the doctors who... as allegedly was involved, because the son himself mentioned it to another individual, and now he refuses to even talk with us. But we still, we're not done with him either.
I even went to the National Military Chaplains, wherever their office is in Washington. I called the chaplain, you know, the military chaplain headquarters. And as soon as I mentioned Hankerson, he knew why I was calling. So, and he wouldn't tell me. He says, I can't give you any information, but I know why you're calling. It has to do with Roswell, right? I said, yes. He says, well, goodbye. So that's
this
what happened.
Really just fascinating to hear that two people could do such extraordinary research. And I'm a journalist. I'm amazed. And nobody paid you guys to do this, I'm sure.
No.
So this is on your dime all the way. And this has gone on how many years now altogether?
Going on 34. And so a combination between the two of us of, 70? I would say, easily say over
almost?
60.
Yeah, oh,
yes.
Yeah.
30... This is 32 for me, and I think like 34 for Don.
Yes.
Just amazing.
Quickly, Jeff, we had talked about Walter Hott, the public information officer.
Right.
And for years we tried to get him to talk, and we always failed, but he would slip and he would admit certain things. And it was like, how are we going to make it comfortable, convenient for him to finally say something? And we decided, and I talked to a number of attorneys, and they came up with the idea, how about a posthumous statement, a sealed statement? something that would be prepared, and he would sign if he agreed to everything that was written. And yes, that's exactly what he did. That's what he agreed to. So he kept his oath as long as he was alive. And I think more importantly, because he was so close to base commander, Colonel Blanchard, that he kept his word, he kept his promise to him as well. And in that sealed statement, he admitted to everything, seeing, handling the wreckage, being out at the crash site, being out at the hangar and seeing the bodies, the way they put together the press release, the way it was all staged for effect, and it worked. And again, it's a legal document in any court of law. And as we've been talking during this last hour, deathbed testimonies are admissible in a court of law for a reason, because the judicial system has long determined that people just do not lie on their deathbeds. That's why they're called last confessions, final confessions. And if we want to throw out Roswell deathbeds, then we got to throw out all of them across the board.
Oh, yes.
Everything.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And they've all been admissible, and they've all been accepted in the in a courtroom. We can't separate the two.
We did ambush Walter Hout on one occasion. We were in his office at the museum. We said, "Hey, Walter, how tall were they?" And he shot his arm out at 3.5 feet off the floor. And whoops, he realized he made a mistake. But that's how tall they were. So
that's
caught him off guard. He wouldn't tell us much.
His statement. Give me a little thumbnail sketch of the statement, real quick. How long? How detailed?
The staff meeting and who was there. I mean, people that we suspected, he confirmed the fact that he was out at the crash site, that he handled the wreckage. They were passing it around the very office, the public information office, and that Blanchard took him out to the very hangar where the bodies were before they were shipped out, and he witnessed the bodies and the craft. He described the craft as being egg-shaped, size of a Volkswagen Beetle, and then that he was sent home to hide out. And that's how his boss put it. You go home now, because he had a stack of media inquiries on his desk, 6 inches high, from all over the world. And that was the best way that they could keep it from leaking out. In other words, hide out, go home. You're not going to answer any questions.
So when anybody called the base, the answering person would say, you want to call the sheriff, Sheriff Wilcox, the county sheriff, for information, for further information. So they'd call the sheriff, and the sheriff would say, "I can't tell you anything. I'm just helping out the fellows over at base." So it was a circular, circular program to tell them nothing. You call him, and he says, "No, call them." And so that's how they handled it.
It's called being volleyballed.
And Colonel Blanchard conveniently announces he's going on leave at the time, when in reality he was out at the crash site setting up a base operations location. And Jesse Marcel, the head of intelligence, he is quickly sent over to Fort Worth for the balloon press conference. The rancher who reported the crash in the first place, he's abducted in total violation of his civil rights. He's abducted by the military and held out at the base for 5 full days. So all the principal characters are no longer available.
Max,
no one left.
Governor Mabry, Tom Mabry, took a vacation to the mountains and didn't surface for another 2 weeks in Utah for a governor's meeting. So the governor got out of town. And the only one left was Lieutenant Governor,
Joseph Montoya.
Little Joe Montoya, yes.
Wow.
So he got stuck with having to go to the base, or he was already there. And he actually saw the bodies, and that's when he lost it. He called up his local.
And little joke, Lieutenant Governor, you also saw one of the survivors.
Yes,
as
he
well,
did.
Which he testified to that.
Yeah.
He heard one moaning, and its knee was rocking back and forth, poking from beneath a tarp.
So he called his local Montoyistas, his political supporters, young political supporters, get me the hell out of here. Meet me at the water tower. I got to get out of here. And so the Anaya brothers picked him up, took him home where he drained a bottle of Jim Beam and fell asleep on the couch. To forget, he says. Wow. He couldn't. He says they weren't human. They weren't human.
Yes. This is 1947. Remember, everyone. This has been just a wonderful hour. Thank you both. We'll talk to you next month. This is a huge, huge story. It's bigger than a major motion picture could be. It's huge.
Well, Jeff, it was enjoyable as always, and we look forward each month to bringing the audience and certainly reliving everything that we've uncovered, and it's going to be a great time.
Oh, yes, indeed. Thank you. Tom, thank you.
Thank
and Don,
you,
we'll talk to you soon. Gentlemen, thank
Look
you
Look forward
very
to
much.
It, Jeff. Take
okay.
care.
Pleasure. Bye.
Night.
Don Schmidt, Tom Carey. Just, there's history for you. Right there. Come to life. All right, we'll be back. Hang on.